Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the 343 Podcast, where we work tirelessly to elevate the level of discourse and practitionership here in American soccer. Today's an episode about scouting and recruiting. Is it good? Is it bad? How should it be done? What are some tips and tricks? And we dive pretty deep in this one, okay, because we have quite a bit of experience along the lines of doing those two functions over the course of being practitioners here in the United States for the course of 20 years and being pretty good at it, if I might add. So that's the main focus of the episode. But first, Benny asked me to riff a little bit on the news regarding USL angling for Division I status with US Soccer, and also USL talking about implementing promotion and relegation amongst its different tiers. So yeah, a lot of comments on YouTube were surrounding that, wanting to know our opinion, wanting to know how we see it. Everybody seems to think it is a positive development, but you know, there's more to it than the superficial per usual. So I go into that for the first 10, 15 minutes of the show. I think it's quite important, not just for the professional ranks. As I say so many times, if you are not currently involved in the professional levels, it doesn't matter. You need to be aware of what's going on there because it directly or secondarily impacts you at the youth level. It's critically important, parents, if you're out there, even coaches, to understand what's happening at the top of the pyramid because it trickles all the way down and directly impacts you. So, all right. Well, before we jump into the episode, per usual, there are no sponsors to this episode or to this podcast. We sponsor ourselves, and we do that through our own products and services that we offer based on codifying our wealth of experience for your benefit. And whose benefit? Coaches. Number one, if you want to catapult your careers, you go to 343coaching.com. There are both free and premium programs for you there. Join over 1,000 coaches who have gone through the program. And of the ones who took it seriously, my goodness. I mean, the results speak for themselves. The testimonials speak for themselves. And parents, we don't leave you behind. Your kids need proper guidance off of the field as well. So for you, it's 343masterclass.com. The idea there is to accelerate your level of discernment in the soccer world here in the United States so that you can better guide your son or daughter. And for the coaches who are coaching the little ones, 7v7coaching.com is where you want to go. So, all right, with that, let's jump on in regarding scouting and recruiting with Benny Rogers.
So, listen, today I wanted to talk about scouting and recruiting at the youth levels, but I think before we get into that, we got to give the people what they want, Gary. I mean, I've seen a lot of comments on people asking you to give your thoughts on this new USL league that's coming out and supposedly it's going to compete with MLS. So I don't know, maybe that takes up the whole episode today. And there's a lot of things to bring up in that aspect, but if not, we can get to the other stuff. But just, you know, what are your initial thoughts when you saw the news? I know we talked about this the last time we met up, where it seems like USL is kind of all talk and they've always said like, oh, we're going to implement promotion relegation. And they've been saying this for years, but it's never happened. It's never come to fruition. So do you think it's actually going to happen? And, you know, if it does, how is this going to change the landscape of soccer in the US?
Yeah, Benny, let's keep this one a little bit superficial because, yeah, I'd like to get into the recruiting and scouting thing that you had planned. But here's some preliminary thoughts, and maybe we can dedicate a whole episode to it next time. So first and foremost, promotion relegation is not implemented by leagues. Okay, Promotion relegation is not some sort of league format, okay, some competition format. Promotion relegation is a synonym for an open market, okay, an open ecosystem, a laissez-faire economy. That is what promotion relegation is actually all about. So when one says, oh, you know what? Company X is going to implement promotion and relegation, or company X is going to implement quote-unquote open ecosystem, it is completely nonsensical and falls in its face from the get-go, Benny. Governments implement open ecosystems, or governments regulate open ecosystems, or governments are the ones who can break monopolies and create a fair and open marketplace for a bunch of companies to compete with one another for products and services and for supremacy. So when we say League X is or is not going to implement promotion relegation, it's hilarious. It makes zero sense. So folks need to understand that above everything else. Now let's go into phase two, right? Which is, okay, we'll put that aside. Can a league or should a league implement fake promotion relegation, which is what everybody talks about when surrounding the topic of MLS doing it or now USL doing it. So USL has been floating the idea of promotion relegation for many, many, many years, ever since the movement in favor of promotion relegation really picked up steam. And I think a lot of credit for it picking up steam goes to many of the original hardcore advocates for it and loud voices for it. And I'm not going to be shy about it. You know, it started before me and before I even understood its implications and why things suck here in the United States. It started before me with just maybe one or two or three people, most notably a gentleman by the name of Ted Westervelt. Some people might know him by his Twitter handle, Soccer Reform. And he kind of pro-rail-pilled me, you know, for me to at least go down that rabbit hole and start looking at it a little bit more closely. And say maybe around 10 years ago, I started really beating the drums. And if you recall, 10 years ago, Ben, is when 343, you know, was a super darling of the soccer world here in the U.S. And our megaphone was extremely loud because we were so ahead of the curve with respect to the use of social media also and blogging also, way ahead of MLS, way ahead of anybody. And so I think we pro-rail pilled a lot of people who then, you know, I passed the baton on to, and I kind of took more of a back seat because I have so many things on my plate. So long story short, I think most folks, advocates in the ecosystem, still don't understand that leagues don't do pro-rel, and now USL has been dropping this hint for 10 years. We're going to do it, we're going to do it, we're going to do it, or 5 years, we're going to do it. And everybody gets excited and nothing ever comes of it. The last most notable moment was maybe 3 years ago or so, where there were reports coming out that the USL owners had a meeting or two or three meetings on changing the calendar to make the calendar be like Europe or the world rather, and then also implementing promotion relegation. Nothing ever happened. And now this, the news drops now that, oh, USL is going to apply for Division I status and is thinking about promotion relegation. I don't believe anything until I see it. If they were truly sincere, I think what they would do is actually lay out the plan. Okay, we're all on board. We're going to actually do this. And here is the timeline. Here are the requirements that, or the benchmarks that need to be met for us to fully launch it, and kind of put it in black and white in the rules, basically, of the league itself. Until that comes out, I think it's a bunch of lip service. And even if it does come out, I think it would be great, honestly, for the ecosystem, even though it's not the real thing. And MLS is probably going to have to react to that and do something. Ultimately, where all this goes to is if MLS wants to preserve an iron fist monopoly, even more so than it has now, they're going to have to pursue maybe purchasing USL, just buying the whole thing outright and then unifying everything, and it'll be all theirs. This is why it's up to the regulator, U.S. Soccer, to actually implement a plan towards a true open ecosystem, thereby breaking the monopoly or monopolies. And look, I'm not saying destroy MLS. No, MLS can continue operating as it sees fit, fine, but on a parallel track, and they don't even need the division. Why do you need the Division I sanction if there's no promotion relegation? The Division I sanction means, what does that actually mean? So go ahead and be like the NFL. Go ahead and be like the NBA. Go ahead and be like Major League Baseball. Those leagues don't need the Division I designation now, do they? They just operate in their own little circus world. Great. MLS, go ahead and do that. We, U.S. Soccer, are going to implement an open ecosystem for the soccer world, and USL can spearhead it, but they don't get to manage it. U.S. Soccer gets to manage it.
Yeah, I think I'm just...
So to be clear, my last little comment. To be clear, we can dive a little bit deeper in this next time. I didn't even waste my time reading the reports that were put out there in the media. First off, the media is all full of shit. And secondly, I'm not wasting my time because I've seen this song and dance in this movie so many times before. I'm wasting 30 minutes of my life reading any report.
Yeah. For me, Gary, I'm trying to understand what you mean when you say, like, it's not the real thing. Is that because, like, for example, let's say you wanted to start your own team, there would still be gatekeepers that exist that wouldn't allow you to go and actually compete into USL. It would be the top USL teams saying, like, oh, these are the divisions. Nobody else can come in unless you get our approval. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, good question, Ben. So let's look at what an open ecosystem actually means. It means I'd be able to start a club whenever I want, wherever I want, however I want, but at the lowest levels, okay, whatever the lowest level happens to be, and then earn my way up and down the pyramid, you know, with purely my capabilities, my team's capabilities, my business capabilities, my investor capabilities, so on and so forth. Well, if a league implements it, let's say like USL, we'll have to see what rules they implement. And as soon as they start implementing rules, then you're restricting competition, as I just described. For example, there's always been these rules about territory rights, because again, these are franchises. And to preserve a franchise's value, they ascribe a territorial monopoly to the different franchises that they allow to exist in USL. So if I wanted to start one here in Orange County, for instance, which is where I live, the gatekeeper will probably say, no, you can't do that because Orange County Soccer Club operates in your territory. So you can't start a USL club, even if it's in the fourth division or fifth division or the 27th division. You can't start one because Orange Soccer Club already has a USL territory there in Orange County. So that's not an open market, Ben. That's not an open ecosystem. That is not true promotion relegation.
Yeah. And so it would have to come from, like you said, the government is what, you know, implements this promotion relegation. So in this case, the government is U.S. Soccer. U.S. Soccer would have to say, hey, now the system is open, write it in the rules, sanction it. And that's how it would be a true promotion relegation system.
Correct. So you have to sit down at the table with, say, USL, U.S. Soccer would, and be like, this is great, guys. We're going to support you. We're going to do our part. Here's an outline of what this sort of structure or ecosystem looks like. We'll take your input. You know, we'll go back and forth and kind of solidify the regulatory environment, because USSF is the market regulator. That actually is their charter, and everybody understands this. And this is why MLS captured U.S. Soccer and now controls U.S. Soccer, so that U.S. Soccer doesn't do these sorts of things.
Right.
So that's really the complication here. And so many of the pro-rel, quote-unquote, advocates, the leading pro-rel advocates out there on the internet, still have not come to the realization that that is the reality of our system. They keep thinking like, oh, we just need good leadership at U.S. Soccer, better leadership, or U.S. Soccer, look, we got to do better. Let's do this. Like, as if it were some sort of independent entity, which it should be, and its charter says it is the independent entity. It's not. It's completely captured by Major League Soccer. So they're fighting a stupid battle of words, and they can't even graduate to the next level to realize what reality is. And once you realize what reality is, then you can actually have and deploy a proper way of do proper advocacy, let us say.
Yeah, that was the last thing I was going to ask you, Gary, because you always say like MLS owns U.S. soccer, basically. So for USL, it's almost like no chance that MLS is going to allow the system to become open, right? Because then, like you said, they'll have to start thinking, what's the next move? Are we going to purchase this? So you don't foresee this happening, Gary? Truly, like a real true promotion?
Like the real thing? I don't see it, because the public still is blissfully unaware of how things work. And and how things work here is the powers that be operate based on public perception and react based on public pressure and public force. And so long as the public is still ignorant of these sorts of things, then U.S. Soccer feels absolutely no pressure whatsoever to do what it is that they're chartered to do.
Yeah. No, a majority of the public can be like, oh, look, they did implement promotional relegation. And at the end of the day, it's actually, they're getting kind of fooled because it's really not the true thing. But, you know, they're keeping the public perception happy and that's all they need.
100%. And the one last thing before we should move on to the recruiting and scouting topic that you had prepared, and many of the parents here want to hear about, I'm sure, and coaches as well, is it interesting timing of this announcement as well, because it came on the back of a court ruling a week or two ago of the NASL antitrust lawsuit against US Soccer/MLS. So NASL, the former Division II league that folded, you know, close to 10 years ago at this point, they started an antitrust lawsuit claiming that MLS and US Soccer are in cahoots and collude one another to destroy them and benefit MLS and also benefit USL, because USL had apparently agreed to be, you know, the bootlicker of Major League Soccer and US Soccer. So the court ruled against NASL. Apparently NASL was not able to, in the court's opinion, prove of that collusion. I'm not surprised. I kind of predicted this would happen the whole way through. And yeah, that's a whole other rabbit hole, Benny, surrounding the justice system and my opinions of the justice system and how it operates. But
anyway. Probably the judge was a huge Seattle Sounders fan.
He loved Jordan Morris so much that he's like, "No, we can't allow this."
Yeah. There's no chance here. You're getting after my boy.
Bro, yeah. So anyways, the timing is interesting because since NASL was a ruling against them, you know, pro-rel advocates or open ecosystem advocates and people who don't really like Major League Soccer obviously are not happy about that ruling. And so now it kind of makes sense if USL wanted to inject its hat in the ring. Now, I think it might be more difficult from a public perception standpoint for US Soccer to also kind of slap USL and say, nah, you don't get to do what you want to do. Yeah. You know what I mean? So it's a public perception play.
All right. Well, it sounds like we might have to have a whole episode on this topic because there's a lot more rabbit holes that we can go down, and maybe people can even interject their comments and, you know, what any other questions that they might have. But and Gary, in terms of, you know, recruiting and scouting, I think it's no secret. And we mentioned this before, right? The amount of time and effort that Brian put into, you know, on the weekends, even after coaching his own games, spending hours and hours on the field, you know, looking for the next potential player, even, you know, showing up to Sunday leagues or Mexican leagues or whatever it was. So in terms of when you want to go and recruit a new player for the team, number one, we could start here. What's the biggest thing that Brian looked for or that you would look for in terms of recruiting a player to your team? You know, is it strictly soccer ability, or is there also that mental side of the game that comes into the equation when you're scouting this player?
I think there's levels, yeah. And the first level, okay, if I'm going to decompose it, right, Benny, because the fact of the matter is the reality is, just like in any discipline, the longer you do it with serious obsession, serious dedication, serious focus, the better and better you become at it, Ben. So I think it's gotten to the point where you quote unquote just see it. You know what I mean? So we're not like there sitting down and then kind of analyzing and breaking down, oh, look at this guy's technique and tactical and physical and psychological, and we go through a whole like checklist, and you know, we do that for a whole bunch of players, and then we kind of objectively come to a conclusion and that's our target. No, man, we go to a field, or we might be just walking by a field as we go to a game or something else and just observing as we're walking, and then something catches our eye and our brain already has the pattern recognition. Even if it's just one touch, Ben, or two touches, or one dribble, just one action, it could already turn our head and be like, okay, interesting. And then we might stop for a moment and not continue to our intended destination and sit there and look and stare at this particular kid for a little while longer. And then maybe just three or five more actions or five more touches. And we're like, okay, almost already good to go. Right. The thing that's important to note is judging their the player's capabilities relative to your existing team's capabilities. So if you're a mid-level team, let's start with bottom. If you're a low-level team, Ben, at the lowest of the totem pole, then all the wealth of talent that would help your team out there, you can just stop at any field and almost everybody will help you out. And you get the idea. If you're a mid-level team, then the pool shrinks a little bit, but you still 50% of the players out there would help your team out. The situation with Brian, especially with the famous teams later on in the youth career, is that they were at the top of the country. And so the pool has basically shrunk to almost zero at that point. And so you really have to be something special for you to catch our attention. And the specialness is easy to identify. But then if there's more than one or two special ones, then you maybe want to dig a little bit deeper, because you can't recruit five kids, right, to your already super stacked team. And so maybe it's a pool of five, and then you start looking at those five players over the course of weeks and months, and then maybe dissect more and more and more and more, right? And so I think that's what you're asking for, Ben.
Yeah. Yeah, Gary, and you mentioned the pattern recognition. Like, that's so true. And if you have consistently watched soccer at a high level for 10, 15, 20 years, you're exactly right, Gary, in that you can kind of just see it. It's hard to like explain or describe what it is, but like you see the players that just have it, right? And for example, even on my high school team, there's a young player. I won't mention her name, but she's a sophomore, right? A Mexican-American background, played in, you know, Sunday leagues growing up. And to the untrained eye, Gary, I've heard a lot of comments from other parents like, this player is a ball hawk, doesn't know what she's doing, like technique. But for the players and parents that have actually, you know, been in the game for long periods of time and have watched high level soccer, they come up to me after the game and it's like, wow, this player is special. This player has that it factor, you know? So you really have to have that kind of trained eye, and it doesn't happen overnight. I mean, you have to spend hours and hours and hours watching the games at the highest level to be able to have this pattern recognition. So especially for newer coaches, that's why, you know, watching the game is so important, because then you can start to dissect, okay, you know, I see Tony Cruz, I see this one and the way that he moves his body and his stroke and his techniques. And even though a kid at 12 years old might not have the exact same capabilities, you can notice the similarities for sure between the two players. So that's why it's so important watching the game at the highest level.
Yeah, totally, Ben. And so pulling on that thread a little bit more, as you can imagine, once in a while I copy you on emails when I'm responding to some emails. You can imagine I get videos sent to me from, you know, parents maybe advocating for the kid, or scouts advocating for their potential target, you know, and they're saying, hey, Gary, take a look at this player. You know, you should do something with them, either bring them to your teams or, you know, from the agency side, you know, maybe you should look at him. This should be a pro, or this is a pro. Can you help further their career or something? You can easily see who doesn't have it also from the right pattern recognition. So the opposite. And it's also instant. You know, you can just see them with one or two or three touches, and you immediately can bucket them with 99.9% accuracy. I'm not going to say you're right 100% of the time, just because, you know, I'm training in the sciences and that's something you don't want to say, but 99.9% of the time you can immediately bucket them pretty accurately. And most of the stuff that I get sent, this player's a baller, incredible. After 10 seconds of the video, it's over. Like, no chance. Yeah, no chance whatsoever.
No, Gary, so many players get overhyped these days. And like, even in these videos that people send to you, maybe like the first clip is them hitting like a banger from 30 yards out. And then the rest of the clips is like, you know, them shooting but missing, or not even getting close to that one-off goal that they might have had. So I feel like the overhype for a lot of players is, you're so right, Gary. It's like, okay, this kid did it once. Can he do it consistently every single game, you know, no matter what team he's playing or what pressure he's facing. So the overhype is real in a lot of players. In terms of, all right, go ahead, Gary. Go ahead.
No, and even so, this with this particular thing, I'm going to say I have to be a little bit cautious, but I'll say it anyway. Sometimes it's even in the biomechanics, so how a player actually moves. So if you see a player receiving a ball or dribbling or doing any sort of action on the field with the ball, and you see how they run or how they orient their body or how they receive, the biomechanics, forget what the ball is doing, forget their effectiveness, okay? You can immediately say, no, no chance. They run funny. I can't describe what that means of running funny, but you just don't run like a legit top quality player runs or moves. Yeah, yeah. It's just not true. And I'm not talking about the speed of the running or any such thing. It's just the fluidity, the biomechanics of it all. It's broken. Like maybe I don't play golf, but maybe, you know, folks can look at a golf swing and they're like, no, that's all wrong. Your ceiling is here. And unless you somehow magically correct the way you swing, it's over for you. The same thing in football.
Yeah. No, Gary, there's, you know, credit to this guy because, you know, he's committed, but there's this guy on Instagram. His name or his handle is World Cup Dad. And maybe like 4 years ago, he came out saying like, hey, like, I've never played soccer my whole life. This guy's maybe like 30 or 31. I never played soccer my whole life. I'm going to dedicate every single hour of my day to becoming a pro soccer player. And like you see like in the biomechanics of what you're describing, Gary, like this will like, you know, credit to him. He's been training his ass off every single day, like 12 hours. And like this guy, like all of a sudden he's like, oh, I just got invited to train like with a pro team in, you know, in Brazil. And it's like the seventh division or whatever, but and now actually he's like signed to a pro indoor team in the US. But Gary, if you see like his videos, exactly what you're talking about in terms of like the way that he runs, the way that he moves or even passes the ball, you're like, this guy has no chance, you know? Like his end goal is like, oh, I'm gonna make the World Cup roster of 22. Like, come
Eddie,
on,
what is going on? Are you being serious?
I'm serious, dude. I'm gonna send you the guy after.
He's 30 years old too.
Yeah, dude. World Cup dad. This was
Jesus Christ.
Hilarious,
man.
Dude. But no, even, I mean, like, you know, good for him. He has a dream. He's going for it. But you just like, you see one video of it and it's like, dude, you know, good stuff for working so hard, but you're never going to make it, dude. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Along the lines of not red flags, but other things that people think are impressive, but actually are not impressive, at least to me or to us and or to anybody who knows what the fuck they're doing, is they'll either send a resume or they'll verbally say it or in writing, oh, well, this player plays for such and such a team or club, right? They'll play the pedigree card. They play for this team or this club. They made this U.S. soccer ID camp, or they've been to this U.S. youth national team camp, or is actually on this U.S. youth national team itself and actually plays. Like, that has like zero impact on, like, zero, Benny. It's like, yeah, so I don't care. I understand that there's a filter and there's a funnel, and if you've kind of gotten to that point, at least there's something, right? At least there's something. But if we're talking about the very top of the food chain, which is what you opened up, you were asking about Brian recruiting for his teams or whatever, top of the food chain sort of thing. Those things are not all that impressive. And maybe it's a first filter, but, and maybe it's enough for me to like take a look, but then all the other stuff starts happening, right? Either the biomechanics, or you see the first touch, or you see, you know, the lack of tactical awareness, the poor decision-making on the ball, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. And then it's like, it's tough. Or the other classic one, because it's very impressive, usually for the majority, is the number of goals that this player has. Oh, this player scored, you know, 15,000 goals in MLS Next, U15. Take a look. There's some video too. The goal number means nothing to me. It just means nothing. You know how many players I have seen that have scored millions of goals at the youth level, and they're just shocking players, and good for them. You know, not everybody can do that, but the context matters, Benny. Okay, who were they playing? How good is their team? How good of a service do they have? What type of goals are they scoring? Are they tap-ins? Are they luck things? What is their actual goal to miss ratio. Yeah, maybe they have to take 10 attempts on goal to score one. Shocking ratio, but they get 30 attempts per game. You know, I'm exaggerating here, but you get the idea. So all of that stuff actually matters. And I think only watching a player live, not on video, is what's crucial. So if I go watch this kid who scores 50,000 goals live for an entire youth game, and I see all the other stuff, the first touch, you're a striker, right? The first touch, you have terrible hold-up play, you don't make good runs off the ball, you make poor decisions instead of passing it, you know, you try to drive through two or three guys, your shot is of poor quality, poor technique, you know, oh, but he scored two goals that game, I'm not interested. Moving on, you know, yeah. We have somebody way better already, or other people on our list that are way better.
Yeah. Gary, when you're at the top of the food chain, the sales pitch to the parent is a lot easier, right? I mean, I'm sure for Brian, in most cases, it was like, hey, I like this kid. You know, I really want him on my team. And for the parents, it's like, wow, this is the top team coming up after my son. But for the coaches that aren't at the top of the food chain and have, you know, mid-table teams, or you're at the bottom of the table, what is your sales pitch to those parents? Is it like you're looking at the, I don't know, because obviously you're not going to recruit the best kid from a team that's at the top of the food table, but maybe are you going after like the bench players, the ones that aren't playing, and saying, hey, you know, your son or daughter is going to have more of an opportunity to play here? Or what would that sales pitch be if you're not at the top levels?
Yeah. So I'll give you our experience as well, because we weren't always at the top, you know, especially with what I've always claimed is Brian's best work, which folks don't know about, is that OS Orange Soccer Club Rage team from a tiny little club that I think is even defunct at this point, where he took a team from bronze level to the premier top national championship over the course of 4 or 5 years. That was precisely the situation. So how do you actually recruit? It's not that easy. But you also don't go for the blue chip super phenom cracks who are on the national team either, right? So at every level, you're aiming just for that one or two or three or five players that would be basically among the best on your roster at that point. So there's a huge pool to choose from, number one. Number two, it comes down to a sustained courtship over a long period of time until they actually come on board. So you make first contact, you know, you introduce yourself. And at that point, they're probably like, go fuck yourself. You're terrible. Your team sucks or whatever. So you introduce yourself. You maybe make form a good rapport with the parents, because remember, they're in your sphere, right? They're in your ecosystem. So you do see these people, you know, on the fields pretty regularly, whether it be on during tournaments or whatever. You cross paths all the time. Or you go and scout them at their game, even though your team isn't even playing at this field or this tournament, and you make them feel good. Oh, wow, Ryan, oh, Gary's coming to look at my kid again. Like, their team isn't great, but I'm still flattered. You know, they're still flattered about it. And, you know, the Spanish really helped us, in my opinion, or Brian in particular, because most of the recruits were of that Latino demographic, because of the style of play, because of the cultural component, and you're able to form a bond even better, form a rapport even better with them. So imagine this happening over the course of many, many months, and sometimes even over a year or 2 years at that point. And then your team or Brian's team is improving, is winning games, is doing something worthy of remark, right? Because imagine if you're punching way above your weight. That catches attention, you know, like, this team shouldn't be winning these particular games, because you should be getting killed and you're winning. So winning soccer games really matters, because then at least that gives you some sort of buying power. Look, come over here. We're on an upward trajectory. We're winning all these games. You guys are kind of like 500, not really doing all that well. So all of these things lead to eventually potentially closing the sale, Benny, at some point. And then another angle is, even though we didn't really do this all that often, is if a player is on the bench and doesn't play all that much in this other team, then you can maybe entice them to come over and say, hey, listen, I'm not promising, but you're probably going to get 90 minutes over here time. But I think the prior thing that I mentioned is the most important, just a courtship over the course of time.
Yeah. Yeah, Gary, even if you're not winning games, I think the sales pitch has to be like, oh, you know, your son comes on our team, we instantly become a 750 team, or we're going to start winning games, tournaments. Your son or daughter is going to be the star player of this team. And I think the thing that is extremely important, Gary, is like, if you are able to, because I know with Brian, a lot of the times it was like, hey, like no pressure at all. Just come to one of the trainings, you know, just come hang out with the team. And I remember, Gary, every single time we had a new player at practice, it was like, hey, this is, you know, Felipe. Every single one of you better make him feel welcome, make him feel like he's already part of the team. Let, you know, ask him about his day, ask him about what he likes. So making the kid feel valued and important. And then guess what happens at the end of practice, Gary? The kid goes up to his dad. Oh my God, I love this team. Everybody's so nice to me. Like, immediately switch me teams, dad. Like, I'm playing here, you know, versus a lot of teams maybe that have that struggle signing players. It's like the kid shows up, nobody talks to him. They're a dick to him at practice. It's like, why would the kid want to come and play for this team? You know,
Benny, thank you for saying that, because that's over 50% of the battle is actually what you just described. And I had a brain fart. Yes. You invite the player out and the family out to training, not even a guest play on a team for a tournament, or just come to training. What does it hurt? Just come kick the ball around a little bit. And in addition to what you mentioned about making them feel warm and welcomed, and the players on the team make them feel warm and welcome, they get to witness top-notch training, right? Which is what Brian supplied. And so when they witness, holy crap, like this is, number one, a very intense environment, but not intense in the sense of bad intense. Intense in the sense of getting better as a soccer player, right? And then you see the activities, and then you see how Brian runs the activities, and you see how everybody's on the same page and working hard and trying to execute things at a very high level. That is almost 100% not going to be the case where they are currently playing at. Where they are currently playing at is probably a shocking shit show by comparison. A complete mediocre, sluggish, fooling around, not disciplined, not intense, and not even good. And you can tell that this coach, i.e. Brian, knows football versus where you're currently playing at. The coach or the staff doesn't really know football either. So that's the other piece of the puzzle, aside from making them feel warm and fuzzy inside. It's like, holy shit, if I were to fucking train here every week and play with this team, I am actually going to get way better as a footballer.
Right. You hear this a lot, Gary, and especially in American soccer. And I'm curious if there's any validity in it. It's like, oh, just go and recruit the most athletic kid you can find, and then you can teach them all the soccer stuff. I think, you know, at the younger ages, 7, 8, and 9, maybe you can get away with that. But once you start getting into the teens, you know, 14, 15, 16, you can't just go and take a player from the most athletic kid from the football team and implement him into your possession-based team. Like, it's just not going to happen, right, Gary? So can you get away with that at the younger ages? Like, oh, maybe you go and recruit the fastest kid on the track team, and even if he's never kicked the ball, but he's still only 7 years old. So can he play? Can you teach him to play?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's a good potential strategy. Let's say go get the most athletic kid, bring him aboard, kick the ball up to him, and he'll probably doesn't know how to kick a soccer ball in the beginning, but you know, just give him a few months of just shooting on goal during practices, and then he'll be able to punch things into the goal. Sure, no problem. And then systematically try to get that kid up to speed on the technical side of the equation. That's a good starter to the funnel, Ben, for sure. And yeah, much easier than going to recruit somebody who already knows how to play. Yeah, agreed, true, man. But and then the other extreme, which is upsetting here, frankly speaking, or frustrating, the mainstream American soccer demo doesn't understand, is that once you're talking about 16 years old, 17 years old, 15 years old, and folks here go crazy. They even start talking about 23-year-olds, like, oh, he's still young. He can maybe, you know, he's give it time or whatever for a pro. Once you get to those older ages, if your technique, for the most part, now has ossified in many, like you've capped it, Benny, like a player's technical skill, the sky's not the limit anymore. Because up until you were age 16, your biomechanics, the way you receive, the way you pass, the way you deliver, the way you, all those sorts of things have been set in stone for a good amount, right? And you're not going to re-engineer that so that the ceiling of that player now all of a sudden, oh, okay, now he's on course to be Xavi Hernandez or Sergio Busquets, or like, that ain't happening, guys. You know, you're capped at this point. So recruiting the athletes at age 15, 16, 18 years of age, and then teaching them is not going to work out for you.
Yeah. There's a certain point where it's just, you know, game over. I mean, okay, there's a clip. Some people argue LeBron is like the most athletic athlete on the planet. If you've seen a clip of LeBron kicking a soccer ball, it's fucking hilarious. And you just know that even if LeBron were to spend the next 10 to 15 years working on just simply soccer technique, he's never going to get to the level of a high level professional athlete. Have you seen that video, Gary, of like the Lakers team playing soccer? It's fucking hilarious, dude.
No, I haven't, but I can imagine because I've seen so many adults already who really haven't played or barely even touched soccer ball, try to do something with a soccer ball. They look retarded, Benny. Terrible. You would say, oh man, I feel bad. Like you're not an athlete. You would say that is not an athlete, the way that they move and try to kick a ball. Like, you remember there's another football player famously maybe 10, 15 years ago, Chad Ochocinco. Right? It's like, oh, I'm going to go play. And there was like a PR stunt where he went to Sporting Kansas City. They invited him out to Sporting Kansas City to like train with the team or something like it. Fucking the most shocking thing on earth. But he was one of the fastest humans alive. You know what I mean? But you can't do dick. It doesn't. Your speed means nothing.
Yeah. They signed Usain Bolt to like a second division in England or something. It's fucking shocking, dude. That's hilarious.
Yeah, so that is actually the illustrative point of, you know, once a kid is 16 years old, 17 years old, they could be a good soccer player, but your technical capability, the ceiling has now been established. Like, what your ceiling is. Can you get better? Yeah, you can, and you will get better, but you have a ceiling now that is much lower than if they have had all the biomechanics correct by the age of 15 or 16.
Yeah. Another important thing, like on a different subject, I think a lot of coaches only go to scout players from like club teams. Like, they'll go to different tournaments, they'll go to, you know, the club leagues. But I think there's so much hidden talent in Mexican Sunday leagues, or like even in rec or signature programs, you know, kids playing pickup at the park. There's so many different areas where you can recruit players from. And at that point, you know, the sales pitch becomes a lot easier, because if you were to go to a signature team and the kid or the parent has no experience of club soccer and, you know, what it's all about, you can easily say, hey, look, your son has so much potential. Let's get him into this environment. It might be a little bit more expensive, but, you know, there's ways that we can work around it and, you know, let's get him in. So I think if coaches only are focusing on recruiting from club teams, they're missing out on a lot of potential players.
Agreed, Benny, agreed. And I think we're very fortunate to be in Southern California, because there is such a huge pool of players that are outside of the system of the competitive club environment to go ahead and do that. But you're right. And so many times Brian actually recruited for his earlier teams from levels beneath his current team, because there's diamonds all around at team levels, competition levels below his current level. So you weren't always looking at your level or above your level to get players that would end up being the best player on your team. So that's brilliant. And that's easier to recruit too. It's like, hey, come to our team. We're playing whatever the league structure is nowadays, right? We're playing in the mid-tier competition, but you're playing at the lowest or lower tier competition. Come up here and you're going to have a better platform than you currently have. And that it's a diamond in the rough. 100%, Benny. That's a really good point. The other point that I like to start us off on, unless you had something else, is soccer is very unique in the sense that, unlike single player sports like golf or tennis or fighting Or even low number sports like basketball, 5 versus 5, or even very X's and O's driven sports like American football or like baseball even, because baseball is like a lot of single player action versus team action. It's pitcher versus hitter, right? Hitter hits the ball. It's the guy who has to make the play on the field, right? So it's very individually or amenable to statistics capture. You see what I'm saying? To identify who the good players are, who the medium players are, who the bad players are. It's easy in those sports. It's clear. It's objective. In soccer, since it's highly fluid and 11v11, and it's not single player, really, it's not as statistics can't capture who are the best players necessarily. It's a very rare exception where the statistics actually correctly map out who is the best player, who is the second best player, who is the third best player, who is the 11th best player on a team, or let alone the whole ecosystem. It's impossible. So that gives us a lot of opportunity to go and find what you just said. Go to the lower leagues, go to the lower competitions, or even the higher ones, and identify with your eye, with your pattern matching, which is not numbers, that's a good player right there. That could help us out. Let's go get that guy. And I'll end with this. This lets a lot of shenanigans and corruption seep into the system and nepotism, right? Where you can kind of elevate players who are the sons of so-and-so or just trash or shit or doing a favor, quid pro quo for somebody to elevate them to being a pro or whatever. Because nobody's the wiser. It's hard to identify the bad players. If you elevate a shit player to a good team and that player has no business being on this team, it's hard to single them out and say, you don't belong there. You can hide within the group that is 11 versus 11.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, Gary. I mean, the right back or the left back or the holding mid, they're never going to show up on the stat sheet. You know, so if you're purely just recruiting off, oh, this kid has, you know, 15 goals, I'm going to go after him. Or, oh, this kid has 7 assists. Maybe like a lot of players on the field, even if they have 0 stats for the season, they could have still been the best player on the team. You know, creating plays, distributing, pulling the strings, fantastic like defensive effort. So you can't just rely on the stat sheet. And you're right, that's where Gary... there's a lot of opportunities for nepotism to come into play, because if, you know, we always mention like Gio Reyna and Claudio Reyna. It's not that Gio's not a great player, but if his dad wasn't Claudio Reyna, I mean, would he be elevated to where he is today? Probably not.
Yeah. But it happens at every single level. And our audience knows this. They see it. People aren't dumb, right? They might not understand the extent of it, but how many times do you have the coach's son being the starter, right? And being placed at striker so that they can score goals, have opportunity to score goals. And it's like, wait, what? That like, and don't get me wrong. Sometimes the coach's son is the best player on the team. Okay. But come on, sometimes it's not the case at all. And they're being placed in a position to succeed much more so than other more deserving kids. But right. The pro level is quite disgusting, Ben. There's all kinds of shenanigans that go on. And one someday I will come out and teach a lot of stuff that's going on at the pro level.
Yeah. I mean, I don't personally, Gary, I don't think I could coach my own son's team. Like I feel like it would be hard for me to draw the line of, you know, coach and father at the same time. And then even like if I'm putting my son in, I'm going to be thinking like, oh, like, is he getting on the field because he's my son or because he actually deserves to be on the field? So I think that like that situation is hard, you know? I mean, a lot, especially in like the signature or rec levels, Gary, you see that a lot because, you know, sometimes the team just doesn't even have a coach. And so a parent has to step up and it's like, all right, they can be the coach. But I think like in the club competitive environment, if you see that situation, it's just not in the best interest for anybody.
It can be tough. It can be tough for sure. This reminds me of tryouts, Betty. I don't know if you want to talk a little bit about tryouts, because I know that happens across the country and there's a lot of views, mostly negative views surrounding tryouts. maybe you can kick us off in that direction, because this is also part of the scouting slash recruiting topic.
Right. Well, Gary, the thing that's, it's really weird because like the governing body of youth soccer, I don't know how it is in other states, but I know in California, like they're really weird about how you can advertise tryouts. And for example, you can only like post on social media that your team is having tryouts like during certain months of the year. So it kind of is like a gatekeeping system where clubs are saying like, oh, you can only host tryouts during this period of time. So that way, you know, teams aren't constantly trying to steal your players, which is like, it's pretty soft mentality, if you ask me. Like any player should be able to try out at any time at any club. There shouldn't be a window of tryout opportunity for you to move on to the next team. So did that exist back when Brian was coaching, or?
I think it was more open back then, but there were also obviously windows and roster freeze dates and all that stuff, which that I can get behind, right? That once a player is on your team for a season or something like that, there should be kind of some period of time where it's like, okay, you're kind of locked in. Otherwise, how can you really hold a league competition if players can constantly move from team to team throughout the league season? So I get that. With respect to tryouts, I don't know that much because, first off, I don't think we were big believers in just hosting massive tryouts, number one. Number two, yeah, we just didn't participate in that, Ben. We just like wanted to go out to the fields and spot the player that we liked in an actual game environment, right? Because that's where you actually get to see what's what more than anything. So I don't know about the restrictions that did or didn't exist back in the day. I don't know. I don't know what else to say about it, Ben, about the rules in particular. So you're against the rules?
I mean, I get why they do it, because then you would have a lot of teams just hosting tryouts every single week or every month, and there would be constant player movement. But I think you're right. I think there does have to be like that roster freeze of, okay, let's make it like a 6 month cycle or an 8 month cycle. The kid is on your team for 8 months. Nobody can, you know, approach him. And then after that period, okay, yeah, you know, free for all. But I don't know. It's kind of weird how they do it to me, Gary.
It's a delicate balance, because at the same time, you want an open system. You want free mobility. You don't want players to be quote unquote slaves, right? Where like I own you, which is a whole other ball of wax at the pro level. These guys are like slaves. It's honestly like a slave trade. You see it even in the verbiage, the buying and selling of players, literally for cash money, right? You're buying and selling humans. Wild stuff, man. Nobody talks about it. Yeah, so you don't want to restrict that at the youth level as much, but you also don't want total chaos. So yeah, I don't have that answer. All I can say with respect to tryouts, I think unfortunately it's been demonized too much from my perspective, where I don't think trials are evil. I think it's a good tool for potentially filtering players into different buckets, A teams, B teams, this club, that club, the other club. And from a player's perspective, it's an opportunity potentially to showcase yourself, whereby in your current situation, you might not have the best platform. Let's say you're on one of the losingest teams in a particular league, and it's not a very high league, but you're a good player. In your opinion, you're a very good player, and you should be at a better league or with a better coach or with a better team. How else are you going to get noticed if there are no tryouts? You know, because nobody does what Brian did or we did and go out and actively scout. People aren't really doing that. So you need tryouts to actually have a chance.
Yeah. The thing that kind of sucks, though, Gary, about tryouts is like, okay, let's say you do have an open tryout and you have, you know, 30 new kids at your session. It's going to be hard for you to run the sessions that you normally do, because one, you have 30 players who maybe have never been introduced to the type of stuff you're doing. So what do most coaches do at tryout? You know, set up a field, you let the kids play for an hour and a half, and then are the parents really seeing how you're running your sessions? Not really, because you're just literally letting them play. So that's why I think it's better to like how you guys used to do it. You know, you invite the kid out to your training session. You say, hey, you know, this is the team. This is exactly how we train. We're going to throw Sun right into the session, and this is exactly what you're going to be getting from me. So I think that's the difficult thing about tryout series. I mean, you have so many new players coming out. It's hard for the parents to really evaluate the coach in those moments.
Yeah. So you're looking at it from evaluating the coach. I'm looking at it more from the coach's perspective or the club's perspective. It's way too hard to do what Brian and his staff did, which was relentlessly put in countless hours to go out and scout players and pluck out the one or two or five players that you want to come see in your environment, right? It's a lot easier to not do that and then just invite people. Say, hey, we're hosting an open tryout. Come this day at this time. And you get, you know, 10, 20, 30, 50, 100 players to show up. And then you just have them play. And then you rely on your pattern matching capabilities as a technical staff to say, okay, these are the five best players that we see at the moment in our tryout of the 50, right? And then maybe you say, okay, thank you very much, everybody, blah, blah, blah. And then those five guys you invite back again, you know, for your actual training environment. And then you make a decision whether you want to try to recruit them or let them go, you know, and the parent gets to decide there as well. Is this a place for us or not a place for us? So there's that vantage point. So I totally get it. And I'm totally on board. Like, imagine if you don't have time as a coach to do what the outlier crazy shit that Brian would do, you have no choice. This is your only path to potentially improving your roster, getting kids on the team. And from a club's perspective, remember, a youth club here in the States is pure business. It's not about community. It's not about developing players or developing players for your first team, because there is no first team, because there's no promotion relegation at the pro level. There's none of that. It's purely transactional. We need more players to operate our business. You know, maybe we lost 10 players. We need to acquire 10 players. Or if we want to grow our club, we want to grow the number of teams that we have. We need to host open tryout. Come on, everybody. Come on and try out. We're going to pick out, or we're going to form a new team, or we're going to form five new teams. And that's the only way that they can do it, Benny. They can't go out into the marketplace and selectively pick guys and try to recruit them.
Right. Yeah. I mean, for most clubs, it's like you have 30 kids at a tryout. Every single kid is making it to your club. Maybe it will be on the top team, or maybe he's going to be on the lowest team. But guess what? You showed up. You have a pulse. Congratulations. You're on the team.
Yeah. And then I understand why there's such a negative connotation to tryouts, because, you know, the loudest parents or loudest people are the ones who feel that they've been done wrong, right? So they go to a tryout, and then if their kid gets selected for the B team or the C team and not the A team of the club, they're like, what the fuck? Like, my kid's good. Why is he on the C team, or why is he on the B team? And they say, coaches don't know what the fuck they're doing. The technical staff doesn't, this club is disorganized. They have no idea that my Johnny was the best player at the tryouts. He scored 5 goals. Like, why is he on the B team? So you only hear those stories. You don't hear the stories of the parents who went and the kid tried out and they made the A team, and all of a sudden they play all the games on the A team. Those quote unquote success stories, they're not yelling out on the internet. It's the other ones who are yelling on the internet. So you have this sort of vicious cycle that exists that demonizes tryouts.
Right. We can end with this, Gary, because I'm curious, but was there ever an instance where, like, Brian or you recognize a kid, you saw the pattern recognition, he had all the right qualities, and then you put him into the team environment and his mentality wasn't there, or he just didn't jive well with the other players? You know, were there cases like that?
It's almost always that component. So to repeat, players are comprised of 4 major compartments, right? The technical, the tactical, the physical, and the psychological. The physical is the easiest thing to identify. Like, how athletic is the player? What are their athletic capabilities? It's the easiest thing. And it's no coincidence that that is what the American mainstream demographic usually talks about and focuses on, because it's the most superficial and easy to identify. You don't have to develop 10 years or 20 years of pattern recognition to do that. You can get somebody off the street and they'll know that Chad Ochocinco is a great athlete. Okay. That's easy. The technical is a little bit more difficult, more challenging, but still a typical human can kind of see, oh, well, this kid can actually control a ball better than that kid in many contexts. So that's not that difficult, roughly, right? Because it gets really nuanced, okay? The next most difficult thing is the tactical, because then you have to be observing the player's decision-making capabilities, and you have to have a really good understanding of the game and game models and philosophy to then judge what are good decisions and what are bad decisions and deploy that across all the different positions on the field and know every single position on the field, what are good decisions and what are bad decisions. So from a tactical perspective, it gets really difficult now for the common soccer person to say, that is a really intelligent player there. That starts getting reserved for already high-level practitioners, frankly. And then the most difficult thing to identify, Ben, is what you mentioned. Most difficult thing is the psychological or the mentality side of the equation. Because especially at the high end, if you're trying to recruit the quote-unquote the best players, well, the best players are usually excelling in the technical, the tactical, and the physical, because they're dominating their team, they're dominating their age group, they're dominating the region, across all parameters. They have the pedigree already because somebody has identified those things and they're on the best teams, or they've made youth national teams, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, right? But you don't know the mentality equation until they're in your environment and until they are faced, most importantly, with challenges and obstacles. You don't know how they're going to react. You don't know how they're going to react. So to your question, have we recruited players that didn't pan out? Absolutely. Absolutely. And it is predominantly on the mentality side of the equation. And many times, since we were talking youth at the moment, and even at the pro level, but many times the parent is also part of the issue there of the mentality failure, because it's a family unit, perhaps. And if the kid isn't playing that much or is not performing that much or is not performing in the position that they're being asked to play in, then shit happens upstairs and it's a vicious cycle.
Yeah, Gary, it's really funny how the kids are really like mini versions of the parents. It's like if the parent is always coming up to you and thanking you and, you know, never has complaints, you usually find that kid has a great attitude and is always willing to work hard and practice and is a good teammate. Or you have another parent that's always complaining or talking shit on the sidelines and yelling at the games. You often find that their kids are the ones with the worst mentality as well. So, you know, the parents have a huge, huge imprint on the kids, and they really are kind of like mini versions of the kid. You could tell a lot how a kid's going to be just by talking with their parent.
But it's still complex, Ben, because you don't know how they're going to react when there are serious challenges in the way. When everything is going fine and honky-dory and everything is good, then the mentality is good. The mentality is good. Everybody's happy. You want to work hard. You want to show up on time. You're all on board with the culture. Everything's fantastic when things are going good. It's when things aren't going, quote-unquote, good, that the true character, that the true psychology, that the true mentality starts creeping out, and you get to observe what it's like.
Yeah, wait till the first loss that you have as a team, and you'll see everybody's true colors.
For sure. And it escalates from there. What if you lose two in a row or three in a row? Then it really starts unraveling, and you really start seeing where everybody is actually at.
What if you didn't win a game all season, G?
Yeah. No, and on an individual front, it's the same thing, you know. Wait until you bench a player, right? Yep. You see maybe a little something, but not the whole story, because they might swallow it, you know, to a certain degree. Wait until you bench them twice in a row or three times in a row, and then it starts developing.
All right, brother. How does promotion relegation tie into all of this? I know we mentioned it at the start, but
sure.
Just to wrap it up with, how does promotion relegation tie into recruiting and scouting players for your team?
Great. So if there was an open ecosystem, Benny, and we're talking youth here, but we can include the pros too. If there was promotion relegation, then every club and every coach has an incentive to actually go and do the hard work of scouting, like Brian did, the outlier level stuff of scouting and learning how to recruit and be persuasive in your recruiting and developing your eye for what is a good player, because you can't make mistakes. If you make mistakes, then that's going to cost your team. And with promotion relegation, costing your team means you don't get promoted and you might get relegated. So the incentives are to be good at all of those things. Good at developing your eye for what is a good player. Good at going out and actually scouting games and trying to identify players that you potentially want to recruit. And then good at actually doing the recruiting. So the level of all of this goes up, and the filtration of players into their appropriate competitive buckets gets better and better and better. And the nepotism that we described earlier, or things associated with nepotism, like I do you a favor, if you do me a favor, let's get this kid on this team because the parent maybe is politically connected or has money or is, you know, going to volunteer on the board of directors of a youth club. They're going to be the treasurer. All that shit starts going out the window, right? It's not completely, but it'll be reduced 99% here in the American soccer ecosystem. So it's an alignment of incentives towards doing good work on the field, Ben.
No more lazy coaches, Gary.
It gets harder because a club doesn't want to hire lazy coaches who aren't going to go scout and recruit. A club is going to say, this is a great recruiter. That guy is a great scout. And by the way, with promotion relegation, it may not be on the coach anymore, because the club itself is incentivized to deploy resources to create its own little scouting department. So you as the coach, Benny, won't have to go out and do all this work. They need you on the training grounds and training the team and developing the players. So a youth club will have their own little scouting department. They'll just hire scouts. Hey, guys, it's the weekend. You, Joe, are assigned to these three games. You, Mark, are assigned to those three games. And Jennifer, you go and check out these three games and report back to us if you see any players of quality and what positions, et cetera, what positions they play, so on and so forth. And then Michael, man, your hit rate when you actually go after a target to recruit him is like through the roof. You always get our man. So we just identified Josh so-and-so. Go get our man, guy. That's what would be developed if we had promotion relegation, Ben.
That sounds kind of nice, Gary. I like
that. It's amazing. It develops the entire ecosystem, Ben. It's incredible. Right now, there are no incentives to do any of that. So what do clubs do, or what do coaches do? Open tryouts, everybody. Just come on in and we'll pick everybody for the most part, you know, because we just want to build teams just because you get to pay us more and we get to grow our club that way. Those are the incentives now, Ben.
All right, brother. Good stuff.
Okay, dude.
I like this one.
Good. What's that equation behind your head?
I've been trying to stare at it and learn it, but nothing's coming to me. So,
well, you know, just staring at it is the best teacher, Ben. Nobody should tell you what it is.
I'll just stand here for the next hour, and by then I should have it. No,
by osmosis for sure, man.
Yeah. All right, brother. Good
okay.
stuff.
Well, that's it for today, guys. Thank you for listening. A reminder for coaches: you can get both the free and premium coaching programs at 343coaching.com. Don't let anyone tell you your teams can't win by playing dominant possession-based football while also developing individual players to the highest levels. Nonsense. We've proved it at every single level, and so have hundreds of serious member coaches across the country. Now that we've moved on to the pro level, we're delivering everything we've learned in the program. Don't wait and continue delaying getting on a proven path. And parents, 343masterclass.com is where you want to go to get a working compass for navigating the American soccer landscape with your player. It's pretty bad out there, but let our experience guide you. Lastly, if you're coaching 7v7, we've got you covered there as well. Go to 7v7coaching.com. Until next time, cheers everyone, and keep building.